Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'm joined by local filmmaker Anthony Laddish. He's made two short films inspired by reel-to-reel tapes that belong to his father and that tell a side of the story of Kansas City jazz that most of us haven't heard or seen. Both films will be showing at the Kansas International Film Festival next week. Anthony, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
The story begins when you find some tapes, just as I mentioned, and they belong to your father. You found them after he died. What was on these tapes, first of all?
After World War II, my dad kept in touch with, he had a tight group of friends during World War II. They were stationed in Quonset Point, Rhode Island. And after the war, he kept in touch with his friend Charles Embry, C.B. Embry, otherwise known as Riff Charles or The Brush. But they kept in touch with reel-to-reel taped audio letters. So they would basically have like an old tube Ampex reel-to-reel player and a microphone. And in Embry's case, he was a piano player and a singer. So he would play piano and sing songs and then, you know, just send messages back and forth, you know, to my dad. And then my dad would reciprocate. And my dad was, didn't sing. He played the drums. So my dad was kind of the technical guy. So he would do like little like sound effects gags. Like he would, you know, write a skit and then record it and overdub sound effects and send those back to CB. And, you know, they would kind of go back and forth across the country like that.
So you found one side of the correspondence, I'm guessing?
I did. It kind of, you know, the whole thing kind of goes back, you know, honestly, when I was around 12 or 13 years old, I was just like a skater kid, just like a punk kid, you know. And I remember one day my dad called me down into the basement because he wanted to share with me these tapes. And he was like, oh, I have this friend, during the war, and he was this really cool guy, and you should really hear this. And he starts to try to explain all this stuff to me, and he plays me one of these tapes, and I was like, ah, that's really cool. I'm going to go out and skateboard now. You know, I just didn't care, you know, because you think, you know, why pay attention to it? And then
because
after
you're 12 or 13.
I'm 12 years old. I just want to go skateboarding. You know, you just kind of become a, you know, whatever. You know, I think
stop
every,
telling
every
me amazing stories
every
right
12.
Now.
Yeah. Stop. Yeah. Stop being so cool. I think every 12-year-old's a narcissist, really. You know, it's like, I just don't care about anything but myself. So I just was like, oh, that's really cool. I'm going to go outside now. And then after he passed away, my dad passed away really, you know, he got sick and he passed away really quickly. Like, I was 19 years old. And I vaguely had this remembrance that he had tried to explain all this stuff to me. And I knew that Embry's nickname was Riff. And so, you know, when I found all these tapes, I found a handful of tapes, and it was like Riff and Mandy, and then there was one that said Riff Charles, and one that said Riff and Scatman, and you know all these tapes, and so those were the ones that I really, you know, centered on when I took this box of tapes out, and the rest of it's kind of it's all the recordings are just magic.
Yeah, and we're gonna hear a little bit of them in a bit, but I want to hear more about what it was like for you personally to discover these tapes. I mean, you're just 19 years old and you've lost your dad, and here are these tapes that connect you with this intimate conversation he was having with a friend over many years.
After, you know, threading up the first tape that said Riff Charles on it and hitting the play button, the very first thing I heard was literally one of the most melodious voices I've ever heard in my entire life. And this guy says, "Ladies and gentlemen, for all the Freudian existentialists, for all the Zen Buddhists, for all the subterraneans of the Beat Generation," you know, and it goes on, and it blew my mind. I mean, it absolutely just
the sound of it.
Just the sound of it, but the words, and, you know, he makes these references to Lord Buckley and the subterraneans of the Beat Generation. I absolutely just completely obliterated my brain, and it was a world that I didn't know existed, and it was a father, you know, my dad's friend, ipso facto, my dad was this cool too, because they're having this conversation, and I am kind of hearing one side of the conversation. Now, I did find a handful of, you know, pieces that went back from my dad, because what they would do, and this is actually sort of technical, but a reel-to-reel tape has a left side and a right side to it. And what they would do is one of them would record on the left side, and then the other one would get it, listen to it in mono, flip the tape over, and record on the left side, effectively the right side you know, of the other side, but would record backwards and then send the tape back. So, you know, in one ear, you got one person talking forwards, in the other ear, you got somebody talking backwards. And so, you know, digitizing all that, you know, material and splitting it up and then being able to kind of hear, you know, hear everything. So
I want to get back to the first piece of audio you were just saying you ever heard. We're going to listen to that. We're going to listen to exactly that. We'll hear both some talking, what you call spiels, and you'll also hear a little bit of music. Now, actually, it's later on that we're going to hear the snippet that you just described, but we're going to hear a snippet of the music, and we'll hear the one you just described a little later. Yeah. So let's listen to C.B. Embry, or The Brush, talking to his friend, Anthony's dad, also known as The Mop, here in Kansas City.
Mom, I'm sure glad to have that tape that Christy sent. You tell him, man. I sure appreciate having it. I'm going to write him a letter about the Kansas City Jazz Workshop concert. Very interesting. Very interesting. That cat, what's his name? Danny Tucker. What is that his name? Sammy Tucker, man. He plays. He plays. Yeah. Wish I played. Well, here's another song, as long as I'm doing some original material for you. I've written another song called The Picture of Dorian Gray. Well, it's like Professor Smith said. He said, I don't know anything about women, but I know what I like. I've got a picture that I hang on the wall, but I took it down when the neighbors called. Put it back up when the neighbors go away. It's a picture of a chick named Dorian Gray.
So, Anthony, tell us about what we are hearing.
Sorry, I'm kind of getting a little emotional. We're hearing Charles Embry, C.B. Embry, my dad's friend, in his studio apartment in Los Angeles, California, you know, playing what he referred to as ukulele style piano. And actually, Embry's still alive, and just lovely, beautiful, beautiful man. And I asked him about that, and he said, I said, what do you mean ukulele style piano? And he said, well, he had a short scale piano because he lived in a studio apartment, and it only had one string per piano note instead of multiple strings like a normal piano. And I always thought it was like a stylistic thing, but but so he's playing and he's singing these original compositions, and he's just talking to my dad. And this is the thing that, you know, it just made me smile, because I was like, you know, who's Mr. Smith? What's Dorian Gray? And all of a sudden you go down this rabbit hole of having to unpack all of these references that were just like these hipster references to these guys that were just like a second nature. It's like, you know, us making, you know, jokes about the movie High Fidelity and, you know, it just being a thing, or, you know, The Big Lebowski, and you just say a line and everybody knows what you're talking about. But for them, they had their own set of, you know, of iconography and their own lingo and their own sort of set of references. And it was really, for me, incredibly comforting and, helped me deal with the passing of my father, to be able to fill my mind with this and to be able to try to spend time unpacking all of this information. It was the most incredible fun. And I spent hours in the library here at Miller-Nichols, because Embry wrote for, after the war, first of all, before the war, he was a painter. He studied under Thomas Hart Benton. Here in Kansas City. I hope I'm not jumping the gun here on anything.
No, please.
He studied under Benton, and it's like a crime that his work's not in the Students of Benton thing at the Nelson, because it's really incredible. And he, after the war, he came here from Moberly, Missouri to study with Benton, and then the war happened, and then after the war, he went to the Writers' Workshop in Iowa, and then ended up in California. But late 40s through the early 50s, he wrote for Esquire magazine. And so I spent hours at the library looking through microfilm, trying to find any reference to Riff Charles or C.B. Embry. And I mean, going through years of, you know, issues of Esquire magazine to find all these pieces that he published. And once again, it was just this incredible, like, wealth of information and knowledge, and his writing was so amazing. It's so incredible.
How did you get in touch with him?
He and my father stayed, you know, remained friends, not close, but they remained friends. And, you know, we're in contact the way that people stayed in contact. You know, you just got a number in a Rolodex. And, you know, after my dad passed away and I decided that I wanted to start mining some of this material for artistic purposes, I wanted to do it right. So I wanted to get in contact with him. And just tell him, hey, listen, I found all this stuff. I'm really interested in your work and whatever. And so I just, you know, I started a correspondence with him, and I can't remember if I called him first or if I wrote him, but he started writing me these letters, and they're incredible. These letters are incredible. And because he was at that time, I think he was like 86 or 87 years old, something. No, 85.
He was
years
up
old.
There.
He was up there. And, or as he would say, find a picture of an 85-year-old man and you know what I'm talking about. And, just as sharp as a tack, and still is at 96 years old.
Your newest film, Studio A, tells the story of the friendship behind the tapes, which, as you said, starts in the Navy. But if I understood it right, I mean, they were doing recordings there in the Navy.
Yeah. So, and this is actually just a slight, you know, correction. The Studio A actually also I made a long time ago. I made it like 2005, but I've re-edited it because when I was going to do this screening at the KIFF, they were like, oh, we really want you to show this film. And it was all on DV and it didn't look very good. So I re-edited it because the only thing that was on DV was his interview. But so Studio A, after I had finished Beat Ever So Humble, There's No Place, the film, I called CB and I asked him if I could come out and visit him, and he was very gracious, and he and his wife Barbara, who was just a beautiful woman, lovely lady, they put me up in their house and I interviewed him and talked to him, and they made me dinner and I went and hung out with him. So I have this huge interview, this really long, like 3-hour interview with CB.
It is not part of my imagination of the wartime experience.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, my bad. Okay, so during the war, they were stationed in Quonset Point, Rhode Island. So they never went overseas. And my dad and his friend Ken West and CB, they all worked, and they were all photographers and graphics technicians. So during the day, they had a hangar that was a graphics laboratory and a photo lab. But by night, they would, you know, Embry would come over to their hangar. And they would, my dad had a machine that you could cut vinyl records, 78s, directly from a microphone, and they would turn it into a recording studio. And they called it the Rational Broadcasting Corporation, you know, Broadcasting Over Station WOLF, The Wolf. And then they would make these skits and play songs, and they would do fake interviews with, you know, pretending that they were famous musicians. And, I mean, they were 19, 20-year-old kids.
Yeah.
It's just a mind blower. It's incredible. So, and I have all, and so after I was in touch with CB, he had all of the old 78s from Studio A, and he sent me all these 78s. And luckily I happened to be working at the Mars Sound Archive at the time. So that was convenient, to be able to, have everything, be able to hear it all and be able to kind of get it digitally transferred and that's kind of, so the Studio A film is really about that time. It's about that moment in time when they, by day, were doing photography and graphics printing, and by night, they were the coolest men on the planet.
There was, they have nicknames, and I think, like, before we get too much further, we should establish these three nicknames.
You got it. So Embry was called The Brush because he had a mustache. He said, like Jerry Calhoun, who was a you know, kind of an entertainer. And my dad was called The Mop because he had this crazy kind of mop of hair. And then Ken West was called The Good Doctor. In a letter, he said Ken was called The Good Doctor for reasons unexplained.
What was it like for you to discover this younger version of your dad, who was this guy, this hipster with the nickname The Mop?
I don't even know if I can describe it. It, you know, once again, it just kind of was a mind-blowing experience to think, like, my dad had a life before he was married, before he had me, way before he had me, and not only that, but it was literally like one of the coolest things I've ever seen in my entire life. And they, it was transformative for me because it just went to show me what it did for me. Cause I'm an artist, I'm a musician, I'm a filmmaker. And I'm never fitting into square society. I'm just not ever going to be able to sit behind a desk and do something normal for a living. It's never happening. And I didn't know that then because I was young and dumb and I just had no idea. I was scared to death because I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. But the one thing that I did know was that I was never going to not tell stories, and I was never going to not try to do something creative, no matter how good it is or not. What that did for me was it showed me that I can make movies and be respected at that, and I can make music and I can be equally respected at that, and I can tell any kind of story, any kind of way, and all of those things can inform each one of those things can inform the other thing. And it's like I come from a long line of Renaissance people,
you know? Yeah, you found a role model.
Oh, though these guys were the best role models ever. That's what it was. It absolutely transformed me into the person that I am today.
Your first film using this material was called Be It Ever So Humbled, There's No Place. And if Studio A is prose, I would say that Be It Ever So Humble is poetry. Let's hear a little bit of that audio that inspired this short film.
Ladies and gentlemen, for all the Freudians, existentialists, Zen Buddhas, for all the subterraneans of the Beat Generation who, as Lord Buckley so beautifully put it, don't know where they're going, but they know that they gotta go, because they know that where they are isn't it. A fantasy entitled, Be It Ever So Humble, There's No Place. Sitting in a chrome and leather tomb the other night, square in the middle of that giant graveyard they call Kansas City, I was inhaling some pre-war helium and praying for a quick ascent, when one of the local ghosts faded in, tripped across the floor, sat down at the bar, just climbed right up on a stool there and sat down beside me. I looked around. The way this zombie started lapping up that embalming fluid, I knew for sure he'd been dead a long time. But I was beginning to feel alive enough for both of us, so I started a conversation. Things are sure quiet around here, I said. Not like the old KC I used to know. The body didn't say anything for a long minute. Finally, staring into the blue mirror in front of him, he breathed, Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost? For a moment, I let myself think about how it used to be when KC was a big neon beacon for all fly riders.
And that kicks off a reminiscence of Kansas City jazz in the 1930s. It's a different take on the history of Kansas City jazz, to my ears anyway. The nostalgia that we usually get is there, but there's also a real sense of melancholy and loss. It's not rah-rah jazz, it's what happened to jazz.
Yeah, well, this story was written and published in Esquire magazine in 1948. January.
The
ladies and gentlemen, for all the Freudian existentialists, all of that was actually written at the time of the recording. Sorry. Which the recording was probably 1960, because he makes reference to the Subterraneans, and that didn't come out until like 58, 59. But the copy from I Was Sitting in a Chrome and Leather Tomb the Other Night was all written and published in Esquire magazine. It was 1954. It was January of 1954 was when it was published.
The Chrome and Leather Tomb, would that be like a bar?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bar. And once again, this is just this kind of hipster lingo. And to your point, the melancholy in 1954, Kansas City had a heyday of of big bands. We had, I mean, we had big bands, 20 people in a band, and the war took away all those musicians. So what made Kansas City Jazz, Kansas City Jazz, in a huge way, was this huge sound of these, big band sound. And then it was small combos.
Let's pick right back up with this question about Kansas City Jazz when we return from our break. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with local filmmaker Anthony Laddish. KCUR's Central Standard will return in just a minute. This music is C.B. Embry, The Brush, performing Sweet Lorraine on a tape to his friend, The Mop. Don't go away.
Well, I love my sweet Lorraine.
Hi again, Anthony.
Hey.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR with filmmaker Anthony Laddish, whose father left behind a treasure trove of musical correspondence on old reel-to-reel tapes sent back and forth with a guy named C.B. Embry. Those tapes have been a major source of inspiration for Anthony's films. We were just talking about Kansas City's kind of mythology surrounding jazz, and Anthony, what's the story? How does the story in these tapes depart from the story we maybe usually tell us ourselves about Kansas City jazz?
Well, I'm no musicologist, so I can't claim to really be an expert about anything. But just my opinion is, we own Charlie Parker. When you say Charlie Parker, you think Kansas City. It's as synonymous as barbecue and jazz and baseball. It's Charlie Parker, The problem is that Charlie Parker didn't become Charlie Parker in Kansas City. He became Charlie Parker in New York City. So bebop was New York music. It wasn't Kansas City music. Kansas City music is big bands, and it's these big head arrangements and these kind of riffs and this big, giant, powerful swing sound. And when the war happened, as I was saying, all of those musicians that filled those huge bands, they all went into the service, into the Navy band. And at that point, then all you're left with is like a piano player, a drummer, couple of horn players,
a little bit of audience,
a small band. So the war killed Kansas City jazz, and then bebop rose up during that time period, during the war era, and after the war era, post war, because bebop was really passionate, it was like, let's jam all of the passion of these 20 musicians into these five guys. And then after that, so in the 50s, you start coming up with Chet Baker, and you start coming up with, Miles Davis and these guys, cool jazz. And cool jazz, while I enjoy it, it's so detached, and it's exactly that. It's cool. It's cold. The whole point of it is to be kind of unaffected by everything. And so in 1953, Embry, who is a child of this big band sound and this amazing, he comes from, Benny Goodman and Jack Teagarden and Bix Beiderbecke and these cornet players, and Louis Armstrong was his hero. And to come from that sound and then in 1953 be kind of, inundated with, thank you for asking these questions. I've never really thought about it like this. I think Be It Ever So Humble, There's No Place is an absolute indictment of cool jazz. That's to me.
Yeah, sure is quiet.
It sure is quiet around here. Well, oh my God, I just got goosebumps. That's incredible. Thank you.
Well, no, thank you. I mean, what kind of intrigues me about all of this, though, is that the story for you isn't just the city's history and how it gets told. It's personal. It's about understanding your own father. And if you don't mind me saying so, to have lost him at age 19, at that age, you're not quite done having a father. I mean, you just are not. And it seems to me that you're continuing to have an artistic dialogue and correspondence and in a way, keeping that relationship around as long as you need it.
I never got to buy my dad a drink.
Yeah.
I never got to sit down and ask him, all these questions. And I remember after he had passed away and I had made the film and I was doing the work that would become, without sounding, hyperbolic, my life's work, I had I had a dream in which I had a conversation with my dad, and it was really odd because I walked into my parents' house and he was sitting at the kitchen table where he normally sat, and I said, "Oh my God, I can't, you're back." And he said, "Well, yeah, I'm back for a little bit." And he said, and I said, "There's so many things I want to ask you. What was Kansas City like in the 30s? What, you know, and like going through all this stuff." He said, "There's going to be plenty of time for us to talk about that." And he said, "I just need you to know I'm really proud of you." And I woke up just in total sobbing tears.
Oh my gosh. Well, I want to play one last little bit of tape. It's the sound of the brush signing off at the end of the track you used for Be It Ever So Humble, There Is No Place. Let's give it a listen.
I was all alone in the joint. Not a soul in the place but me and the bartender, and him leaping over the bar at me with a sawed-off pool cue in one hand. What was it that cat Thomas Wolfe said? You can't go home again? Mop.
Anthony Laddish, this has been an awesome conversation. Thanks so much for sitting down and talking with me today.
Thank you. Seriously, this has been amazing. Great conversation.
Anthony's films, Be It Ever So Humble, There Is No Place, and Studio A, will be screened at the Kansas International Film Festival next Thursday evening at about 7:30. We'll link to information when we post the audio from today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. It'll be there later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, tune in for a conversation with sports writer Joe Poznanski to hear about the great literary themes that emerged from this incredible Royals season. That's tomorrow at 10. And chat with us anytime on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, signing off for today. Get thee to the parade, be safe, and stick around for Up to Date next.